Elizabeth Press, Brenda Murad, Chuck Skurich, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Pruden, Sharina Nadura. Our director is Becca Staley. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. And special thanks to our team here at Park City Television, Stanton Jones, Kevin Raff, Evan Heath, Aaron Springsteen, Craig Van Straelen, Corey Reno, Yarivia Barrios, and Randy Thieben. Again, our website, democracynow.org, will be in New York on Monday. If you can go to our website at Democracy Now!, you'll see transcripts, video, audio, podcasts, as well as columns and web exclusives. I'm Amy Goodman from Park City Television. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal.
So you can earn your online degree faster, saving time.
Our next guest.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek, station advisor here at WHFR. Remember, we're an independent, non-commercial radio station licensed to Henry Ford College. And our staff is all volunteers, all student and alumni of Henry Ford College. Well, here we are today with latest updates on Dearborn and the surrounding area, as we do all the time. But last week was a sort of a special show just about automobiles and the auto show. Almost a full hour, we talked to the chief editor-in-chief of Car and Driver magazine, and that was a lot of fun. If you want to listen to it and you missed it, good discussion. You know, the second most expensive thing you're ever going to buy in your life, probably after a house, although these days maybe the car is going to cost you more than some houses. I don't know. But it's right there at our website, whfr.fm. Click on Talk Shows, then select WHFR Journal, and then select the date. And it was 1/23/15 last Friday. Today is the 30th of January 2015. One of the things I thought we should do, and so this is kind of a catch-up show that we do after a special show devoted just to one topic, because stuff is happening all the time, right, around town here. One of the things is that you may not have heard formally is the complete response by the Democratic Party here in Michigan to the State of the State address by our own governor, of course. How soon we forget. Rick Snyder. I didn't forget. Just dramatic pause. Well, it's interesting, especially here, and I'm going to devote the next 8.5 minutes to playing this back. This is that response that we dug up on the internet by new state senator, Dave Kinesick. And Kinesick is from this area. He was in the war. He was one of our brave and gallant soldiers, and he went to University of Michigan Dearborn and graduated from there in political science. He got elected as a state representative from the Dearborn Heights area a couple of years ago, and then immediately turned around, and since there was sort of a vacancy, he ran for state senator from that area, and he won. So for a variety of reasons, other than he's the young kid on the block and make him do it, carry out the trash. No, just kidding. He was chosen here in Michigan to make the official Democratic response to the 2015 State of the State address. Now, maybe this was on PBS. I was watching commercial TV at the time. Shame on me, and they didn't run it. But here is Senator David Kinesick providing that Democratic Party response to the State of Michigan address. And he joins Steve Gruber for an interview and candid discussion of the speech. Here we go.
This is State Senator David Kinesic. He is the newest member of the Senate. He is a Democrat from Dearborn Heights. He's also a United States Marine. I'd say retired, but people tell me once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine, an Iraq War veteran. So we'll just stay with U.S. Marine, if that's okay with everybody. Senator, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Well, glad to have you. I'm just going to call you Senator, if that's okay. We'll just go that way.
You can just call me David. You just call me David.
All right, David, how about that? We'll do that. Okay, you focused. You gave the Democratic response last night to the governor's address. Okay, first of all, what about the governor's address? Let's end gridlock here, the five principles to move forward. Let's streamline some government, consolidate a couple of agencies. Your reaction to what he had to say first?
Well, I think that my reaction is very similar to a number of other Democrats I spoke to last night, and that is we thought it was a pretty good speech. And the issues that the governor laid out and the things that he wants to address in the year and the years moving forward, I think is a tremendous thing. Obviously, the concern is that we want to make sure that the governor is genuine, that he's sincere in his approach. And if that's the case, I think that he can count on having a significant amount of bipartisan support in trying to address the initiatives that he laid out last night.
You know, I kind of thought you would agree with that because, you know, I listened to the speech and I thought, if I had my eyes closed, I think I was listening to a progressive Democrat governor and not a Republican.
I was looking out at some members of the Republican Party last night and not seeing a significant amount of clapping. So I think there were some members who might agree with you on that one.
Well, maybe a lot of folks. And you know, maybe Rick Snyder's planning to join your team over there. In part of your response, you talked about the student at Saginaw Valley who works two jobs, crippled with student loan, counting on us. Single mom from Marquette with a sick daughter trying to figure out, you know, whether to stay home and take care of her kid or go to work, counting on us. Factory workers in Muskegon counting on us. What about the people like you and I that go to work every day, that are working hard to send our kids to college, and that are counting on the state legislature to keep their hands off my pocketbook so that I can afford to do the things I need to do? What about, aren't they counting on you too?
Yeah, well, there's no question, Steve. I think what we try to call attention to in my response last night is not unlike what the governor tried to call attention to, and that is to humanize what it is Michigan families are going through right now. Whether it's, again, the folks that I talked about in my speech or the folks that you just mentioned in your comments there, we want to make sure that if you're a working person, that we want to be doing everything that we can to, again, streamline government when appropriate, get out of the way, and to let our residents do what they do best, and that's kick butt and try and make Michigan into the economic powerhouse that we know that it can be. You know, we're not always going to agree on the way to get there, but what I tried to highlight in my response last night was the fact that when we put aside those Democrat and Republican names that come at the end of our titles, when we put those aside, we're able to get back to the business of working together to try and find a common path to our goals. That's something that I'm committed to moving forward in the next few years. I know that that's what the members of the Democratic Party are committed to, and we hope to work with the governor on a number of the initiatives that he laid out last night.
Here's my concern, one of many. Mm-hmm. We're on the phone this morning with State Senator David Kinesic of Dearborn Heights, a Democrat, new member of the body. As I look out across the state of Michigan, I see a plan that's been put forward by the governor and Democrats to ask us to raise our sales tax. And I look out there at a state that has over $145 billion in debt, real tangible debt. Nobody ever talks about that, David. Well, who's going to pay the debt for the state of Michigan, or are we all going to end up being Detroit?
No, I tell you what, Steve, I think first and foremost it's important to note that the plan that was passed was a bipartisan plan. Democrat and Republicans came together to put that initiative before the folks here in the state of Michigan. And I think it's a good thing that we're trying to bring the residents into this conversation and to give them the opportunity to have their voices heard as to whether or not they want to have this additional option to pay for the roads here in the state of Michigan as well. As it relates to the budget conversations on the whole, Steve, I'll tell you this. We have within the Michigan Constitution, a balanced budget amendment. We have to have a balanced budget every year. The question is, what are we going to prioritize in order to get there? And obviously, we've had some disagreements over the last few years about issues related to taxation that you've just mentioned, paying down our debts, being able to take care of the legacy costs that we have for state workers and our other employees. What we want to make sure is that at the end of the day, We're doing everything that we can to put more money into people's pockets. I believe that that is what drives the economy. When people like you and the other people you talked about earlier who are going out, they're working hard, they're trying to put their kids through college, when they have more discretionary income, they're going out, they're investing in our economy, they're creating jobs, they're expanding the economic activity here in our state. And I think that, to be forthright with you, that's something that Democrats don't talk about enough. And that's what we need to be doing to support our residents and supporting our business community so that we can continue to grow and attract new businesses here to our state. You know, the debt certainly is a part of the problem, but it is a piece of a much larger conversation that I don't think that we're having here in the state of Michigan right now.
And David, I agree with you. The problem is I don't think we have that piece of the conversation ever. You know, I hear about, you know, in fact, part of this plan putting that's going in front of voters on May the 5th, if I'm not mistaken, is retiring some old debt from the Engler administration. I'm not even sure. I mean, nothing personal, David. I'm not sure you were quite born when that debt was accrued. I mean, you're kind of a young fella, aren't you? I mean, you're a young man.
Yeah.
And yeah. Look at this. We're retiring debt from when you were probably still in diapers. That's a little embarrassing, isn't it?
Well, there's no question. I think it's also funny, you know, the governor's movements to merge Department of Community Health and Department of Human Services, you know, that's undoing a change that took place under the Engler administration as well. And believe me, Steve, I get it. For me, as the youngest member of the Senate, it's incredibly frustrating when I'm seeing the state going up against challenges that folks who came far before me were unwilling to address. That is exactly the problem that we're facing with the road situation that we're talking about right now. Folks could have taken care of this issue decades ago if they would have passed the right and comprehensive type of tax reforms to make sure that we were paying for the infrastructure that our residents deserve. They didn't do it. And so, you know, I give the legislature, I give the governor credit for trying to take on this issue. I understand and respect the fact that there's going to be differencing of opinions and the dialogue that needs to happen. But again, I look at what we're going to get at the end of the day, $1.3 billion additional dollars for our roads, guaranteed. My biggest problem, and I think you have a problem with it too, is when we tell folks in this state, we're going to tax you for this and we're going to pay for that. But then
it never works that way.
And they take the money out and they start spending it on whatever else. That's not right. We're going to get $1.3 billion for roads. We're going to get $300 million additional dollars for schools. We're going to get $94 million additional dollars for our local government. So again, we can have agreements or disagreements on whether or not it was the best plan. I'll go out there and say that I wish the legislature would have taken care of it ourselves. It might have been a very difficult conversation to have, but the residents did not elect us to keep kicking the can down the road. They elected us to make the tough decisions, and I was willing to make the tough decisions there in the legislature, but the plan that was presented to us, the plan that was developed by leaders from the Democratic and Republican caucuses in the House and the Senate, as well as the governor's office, was the option to put the sales tax increase on the ballot here in May. And like the governor said in his speech last night, I certainly hope that folks do their homework, they do their due diligence, and that they go out and they vote yes, so that we can make sure that we take care of the crumbling roads here in Michigan.
And I guess we'll see what happens going forward. David Kinesic, state senator, a Democrat from Dearborn Heights, and a retired U.S. Marine. Hey, thank you for your service, number one, and I appreciate you coming on the show. Now, you tell your friends there in the Democratic caucuses and parties that you go to that, you know, Gruber's a cream puff. Come on anytime, and he'll let them slide.
All right.
Senator, I greatly appreciate it.
Okay, well, I'm not a cream puff, and I'm not going to let this slide. First of all, it looks like David Kinesic is saying, and that was, of course, an interview with Steve Gruber, who is on WJIM 1240 AM in Lansing. They say it's Lansing's best news station, and of course, it may be the only news station, all news station in Lansing. I don't know. I'm just saying. Not too many stations up there. Nonetheless, he seems like a great guy, that Gruber guy. Anyway, Dave Kinesic seems like he's in favor. He was endorsing the ballot proposal for this May. It's going to be there, folks, whether you like it or not, to not just fix the roads. The money's not all going to the roads, okay, folks? That's one of the problems with this as the details come out. And by the way, it's going to cost $10 or $12 million for the state to have this special election in May. And of course, they do it in May rather than November because, well, too many people usually vote in November. I don't think too many. You know, half of the registered voters were lucky to get voting in any election these days. But in May, only those that care, either care, yes, care, no, about it, are going to be there. So maybe they're hoping that it's going to pass. But Kinesic is saying, yes, people should vote for it, as well as he claims the, I think he was implying that the leaders of the Democratic Party were saying yes, too, even though he personally would have liked to work it out in the legislature. And I think all of us wished they would. The sales tax issue, again, I do have opinions on a lot of things. I don't like to talk about political issues or take sides personally, because you might believe me. Oh, my goodness. Never believe anything, any opinion you hear on radio or TV until you get it verified by a couple of other sources, until you even think about it a lot. Don't be swayed by a big-time TV personality or even a small-time radio personality like yours truly. You've got to think for yourself, but you've got to get more information. And on that topic, to follow up here, about the sales tax proposal to help to raise the sales tax to help fix the roads. Here's a story just came out yesterday, and maybe you saw it on a commercial station, but whatever. It seems that Governor Snyder's consultants on the campaign, the PR people that were planning the campaign to raise the sales tax, it's going to be on the ballot in May, these consultants just quit. That's right. The entire team of political consultants hired to concoct, I like the phrasing here, this is off of the, where did it come from? I think it came from Press and Guide? Normally, I can see where I printed this out from this morning. But in any event, it's real, folks. This group did... Oh, Detroit News. Chaz Livingood reported this. Okay, the entire team of political consultants hired to concoct a campaign to win over voter approval has just quit. One of the consultants involved told Chad Livingood at the Detroit News that the team, which consisted of Lansing-based PR firm Truscott Rossman, who is a pollster for the Detroit News, Richard Kruzba, as well as a Democratic political advertising company, said the bipartisan crew had, get ready for this, quote, philosophical differences, quote unquote, with Snyder's office. The consultant told Livingood at the news, he says, I wish the governor well in his efforts to pass it. I'm adding my own tone of voice to it there. Somewhat ironic, unquote. Lansing-based news service Gongwer, well, there's a name for a news service, G-O-N-G-W-E-R, Gongwer, says that Lansing-based PR firm Martin Wehmeyer and political consultant firm WWP have passed the baton. Michigan, you may recall, has been talking about fixing its dilapidated road system. This article concludes forever. Yep. So the governor wants you to vote yes on the sales tax increase to fix the roads. But again, it's the money would not all go to the roads. And in fact, the way I last read it and the way I told you, I think last week, if not the week before, there's only $600 million that's going to go each year. It's going to take like 2 years before they collect that much money to even go to the roads. We're going to have roads getting even worse and worse for the next 2 years. And then it's not enough. $600 million is half as much as Snyder asked for 3 years ago. And the roads are getting so much worse. We really need a lot more than that for 10 years to even repair them and get up to the point where we can easily maintain them and fix them without this. So we need a huge amount of money over 10 years, now estimated to be about $18 billion to repair our bridges and our roads in the state of Michigan over 10 years. And we need to get started now, or it's going to cost us even more. So the sales tax, very simply, won't do it. Won't do much, anyway. And some of that extra sales tax money is going other places. And you have to look at that issue when we get closer to it before you vote. And I hope you vote. I hope you participate in our democratic system. It does make a difference, especially on issues like this. If you think this is the best plan, if you think our legislators are not capable of anything better, then maybe you have to vote yes, in fact. But If you don't like it, I think you need to vote no. But then the legislature gets it back in their arena, and who knows what's going to happen then. And the roads get worse and worse. Well, you don't want to blame Wayne County for all of them, first of all. And that's one of the problems I have. Because we are a number of cities, and we're in Wayne County, or Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb, and, of course, we're all part of the state of Michigan, different people repair the roads in these areas. In Dearborn, it's not just the city of Dearborn, but also Wayne County. And in the case of, I don't know, an expressway going through, the expressways to a certain extent. Now, state freeways and trunk lines in Dearborn Allen Park, and that is Michigan Avenue, Telegraph Road, I-94, Southfield 4, and I-75, are handled by the state. But at times, Wayne County will maintain these roads if they're under contract from the Michigan Department of Transportation. The acronym is MDOT. Okay, so have they got contracts to fix it? So do we blame them for the big roads in trouble or not? Some of the smaller roads, and I got a list here from Gary Warnchuk's office, Allen Road from Southfield to Outer Drive, and there's a number here, just the ones I recognize, Dix Road west of Miller going to the Detroit border, Hines Drive, Evergreen Road, Michigan Avenue to Ford Road, Hubbard Drive, Evergreen to Mercury, same road actually, folks, but they just changed the name there, Mercury Drive, which is from Ford Road to Hubbard Drive, Oakman Boulevard from Miller to Ford Road, Oakwood Boulevard, Michigan Avenue to 94, Pelham Road, Outer Drive to Rotunda, Rotunda Village to Miller, and so on. Well, you get the idea. If there's a trouble with roads, who are you going to call? That's the problem. Okay, do you call your city? Do you call the county? Do you call the state of Michigan if you want to report a problem? Or you just want to lay blame in your informal discussions with your colleagues and your family? You don't know who to blame. You don't know who to report to easily. I mean, you could start at the lowest level and say, this is a city road, call up the city hall, the Dearborn Administrative Services Building, and ask someone there, is the city responsible for this road? There's a problem. There's potholes or whatever. If they say no, they'll give you some other numbers. Here's a number for Wayne County. Wayne County's 24-hour hotline for the roads. I assume it's just for roads. You can report a major pothole or a traffic signal is not functioning properly 24 hours a day. It's probably a, you know, they take a message, but maybe there's a real person there. 24-hour hotline to Wayne County about the roads, 888-762-3273. I'll do it one more time, and you can listen to the podcast and play it back over and over to get the number if you have to. But Wayne County 24-hour road repair hotline, 888-762-3273. Okay, we covered that. And thanks to WJIM Lansing for that interview. His actual state address, I could have played, but it went on another 6 minutes, and I've already talked more than that now, so with the other story. So there, that was still a summary by Kinesic with a few salient points about what he recommends, too, I think. He's been on the show. I've interviewed him. He does seem like a smart, bright young man, although very career-driven. So he's going to be hopping around before term limits kicks him out, I'm sure of that. And everybody would, I think, to keep a job somewhere. Okay. Let's see. I still have some car-related things from some other newspapers and magazines in terms of best cars and so on that were a little bit different. I thought I might share those at the end of the show with you, by the way. So let's look at some of the things in the local papers here. Times Herald from this week. Not too many stories from local papers this week, but let me grab a couple here. Physically have the papers, but not right next to me at this moment. Oh, my goodness. Okay. In the Times Herald, And we always want to mention special events as we get time at Henry Ford Museum. That's right, Henry Ford, the Henry Ford Greenfield Village is closed until spring. At some point they'll open. I'll tell you about that. But as a nonprofit organization, it's great. Well, I love the museum because as a car guy, I guess it's kind of a car story here, isn't it? They have all kinds of different cars, and sometimes they rotate the exhibit. And it's always fun to look at your favorites, even if it's every week you go there. It's still great fun. Well, what they've done is actually open the hoods. Okay, they open the hoods of 40 cars that they have on display, and you could stare in and look at the engines. That's what makes them go, folks. Got to have an engine there. And admission to this Engines Exposed exhibit is free with membership, or $20 for adults, $18 for seniors 62 and up, and $15 for youths 5 to 12. Those are the normal prices for the admission to the museum there. Great value, folks, to get an annual pass, either as an individual or as a family. And of course, all the special events, both indoors and out throughout the year, discounts on all kinds of things. Yeah, I'm doing like a little commercial, except it's not called a commercial, folks, because they're a nonprofit organization, just like WHFR. I just think it's a great community resource for entertainment and information. And if you've never gone there and you live in this area, well, shame on you. You know, it's so great. Don't take it for granted here. It's really special. And to look under the hood of some of these great, great cars from the past, 40 of them, maybe get your zoom lens on your camera, take some pictures if you're really into it. That's very special. And that exhibit will continue on through March 14th, I think. Through 15th. Engines Exposed. All right. The other issue was the editorial that they had, and the Times Herald editorials are usually always guest editorials on their page. They have, you know, opinions. For example, Brian Whiston writes a nice column about the proof that Dearborn Public Schools is at the forefront of education, and sort of piggybacking on comments made by President Obama and Governor Snyder in their state addresses. Certainly we have a lot to be proud of around here, as well as, of course, Henry Ford College and all in U of MD and all the other educational institutions. But Dearborn Public Schools doing a good job. Yep. So read his opinion there if you like. But the guest editorial, which comes from the Traverse City Record Eagle, it's a little bit mistitled, I think. It says, Free College Tuition Plan, which was proposed by President Obama both a couple weeks before his State of the Union address, but also during his address, which primarily talked about the federal government paying 75% of the cost of tuition to community colleges, two-year programs, all around the nation. But the states would have to kick in 25%, the other 25% of the tuition cost. And how many states have money enough to do that? Well, so this editorial, Traverse City, they point out, they say they'd like to know where the money is supposed to come from. Okay. Still, listen to the conclusion, all right? They totally agree that it's, you know, higher education for those that qualify and continue to qualify once they're in, is one of the best things that we could do for this whole country and the future of this country. Every qualified student should be educated to their greatest extent, top priority, and they shouldn't have to pay for it. Why should only the rich kids that qualify get a college education? That's almost the way it's becoming. Or why should the poor kids who are able to get loans, the poorest can't get loans because they have no collateral. Their parents couldn't pay back the loans, if they were responsible for it. Not everybody can get a loan. But let's say the poorer students who are able to get loans We're talking about $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, maybe $40,000. I talked to a school that was at a little table here at Henry Ford College yesterday, and they were proclaiming it's a public institution, but, okay, it's University of Toledo. Nothing wrong with them. Nice place, I think. They seem to have a lot of good programs. But their tuition for people from Michigan was $9,200 a year. Four-year school, but $9,200. So if, and there's other costs. There's books and all kinds of other things. And if you live down there in the residence halls, there's all kinds of, you know, more than it. But just tuition alone in 4 years, that's $40,000. And if you have to take out a loan for all of that, how long will it get you? You have to pay for that. Most people have a $40,000 mortgage on their house. It'll take them 30 years. Or they might have to remortgage at some point to take even longer. So this is a level of indebtedness that has never happened before in the history of America that is holding back and holding down our future. And pretty much the editorial said it. Pretty dramatically, too, I thought. Good for the Traverse City Record Eagle. But they conclude this way. They say, in Michigan, you know, where's the money going to come from? He says that that's more a punchline than a plan. The state legislature has been hacking away at state contributions to higher ed, including community colleges, for years. We pay more for prisons than we spend on higher ed, and that's not likely to change anytime soon. And as I pointed out from the statistics I see every year or two, in terms of the percentage of the amount of money per capita, per person in Michigan, that the state of Michigan puts out to higher education, supporting higher ed, we're down almost last out of the 50 states. That's how much our government, and of course our government said, well, we have no money. Well, that's how little we, the taxpayers, are putting in to help our own kids collectively get through school to make this a better state, to make this a better nation. So shame on us, but also shame our legislators and or our governor for not telling us the truth about this. So that's why our tuitions are so high in Michigan, is because it isn't getting any support from state government. And a little bit more support than in past years from the federal government, which is now giving a little bit more money to community colleges, but previously they gave nothing. So when I say a little bit more, the lion's share of money for the budget here at Henry Ford College, it comes from tuition, not from the state of Michigan, not from the federal government. It comes from the tuition of our students. And we got to live on that. Now, in a way, it seems appropriate, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, that's only 70% or so, but still have to get the other 30% somewhere. And we do, I think, about, 10 to 15% from local millages. Thank you very much, people of Dearborn. But, you know, more than any other community college in Michigan, we support ourselves based on our users coming to us, but then they go in debt in their own lives in order to make this experience possible. The best countries of the world, the up-and-coming countries, they give free college tuition to all those that qualify. And we're not just talking about 2 years, we're talking about 4 years. Now, that's a role model. And we used to be the best, like in the 40s and 50s, of supporting students who couldn't pay with special grants, like our soldiers coming back from World War II, in order to get through college without being burdened for the rest of their lives with a major debt. And we're not doing that anymore. So shame on us collectively. Shame on our government and our leaders for not taking these steps. So Obama's plan, it's a small step. But it certainly will help. But where are the states going to come up with that extra 25%? The Traverse City Record Eagle concludes their editorial by saying, so expecting the state of Michigan to fund 25% of the first 2 years of college is admirable, but laughable. It's a noble idea, but in the harsh reality of Washington and Lansing politics, it's going nowhere. Well, at this point in time, Continue to ask however you feel about these issues. Continue to tell your local elected representative. Write emails to the governor. Do whatever you can. Maybe they'll listen. I know I've written several emails over the last year to Governor Snyder. I've always gotten a nice response back. No, thank you. We're doing something else. The governor's decided to do the opposite. Well, very polite. Not responsive. Not telling me why, but nope, we're not going to do it. Okay, thank you. I mean, not that what I'm suggesting is the best thing in the world. I mean, I think it is, but, you know, they're not doing it. Okay. Well, moving on. So read it for yourself and think about that. I mentioned the idea of free college tuition, whether it's two-year or four-year, for quite a while. I know many students who have these terrible debts that they're still paying off after 20 years, 30 years of being graduated. And, they can't afford to buy a house. They can't get a nice car. They can't hardly afford to get married. Because if they marry another college graduate, then they have double debt, you know, to pay off. So if this plan is doomed, then I think the future of America is doomed. That's my opinion. And remember, all opinions expressed in this show are not necessarily those of Henry Ford College. And we thank them for allowing us the freedom of speech to do that. And we try to be responsible. Honest, we do. At least I do, anyway. Here's a couple editorials. The first one is from Jim Hightower. Idea is let's adopt the GOP's national platform. Yeah, Jim Hightower. And Jack Lessenberry is talking about Sharia law in Dearborn. Listen up.
Well now, here's some unexpected news. It comes from what purports to be an official document of the National Party. And wow, the policy positions it contains show that the party leaders really are serious about coming to their senses and rejecting the plutocratic extremism and far-right wackiness that has stained their recent presidential, congressional, and gubernatorial campaigns. Right at the top, this 18-page manifesto proclaims that, quote, our government was created by the people for all the people, and it must serve no less a purpose. All the people. Forget last year's ridiculous pontifications by Wall Street billionaires dividing America into virtuous creators, like themselves, and worthless moochers, like you and me. This document abounds with commitments to the common good. Quote, America does not prosper, it proudly proclaims on page 3, unless all Americans prosper. Shazam, that's downright democratic. And how's this for a complete turnaround? Labor is the United States. The men and women who, with their minds, their hearts, and hands, create the wealth that is shared in this country, they are America. Holy Koch brothers, share the wealth? Yes, and how about this? The protection of the right of workers to organize into unions and to bargain collectively is the firm and permanent policy of the Republican Party. Eat your heart out, Scott Walker and you other labor-bashing GOP governors. The document also supports the Postal Service, the United Nations, equal rights for women, expanding our national parks, vigorous enforcement of antitrust laws, and raising the minimum wage. New enlightenment in the grand old party. Hallelujah! This is Jim Hightower saying, can all this be true? Yes, except it's not new. This document is the Republican Party platform of 1956.
For years, there's been an absolutely stupid rumor that the Detroit suburb of Dearborn, birthplace of Henry Ford, is now under extreme Muslim Sharia law. Sharon Angle, a bizarrely ignorant Tea Party candidate, claimed this was so when she was running for the U.S. Senate in Nevada 5 years ago. 2 weeks ago, Jerry Boykin, an anti-Muslim former U.S. Army general, did it again. Boykin, now the executive vice president of something called the Family Research Council, went on a talk show to claim that radical Muslims were so firmly in control in Dearborn that Detroit police only entered the town in emergencies. Well, part of that is true. Detroit cops don't go there, because Dearborn is a separate city and has its own police. But Dearborn's mayor is named Jack O'Reilly, and the city is no more under Sharia law than Roswell is under space alien law. I don't know if Mayor O'Reilly gets sick of explaining all this, but I do know that a delightful young man named Brian Stone came up with a great way to try and laugh this nonsense away. Stone, a 28-year-old Dearborn native, Navy veteran, and college student, has been posting pictures of himself holding a sign saying, "Dearborn Sharia Law," in front of some decidedly un-Sharia landmarks in a city. They include a strip club, a Roman Catholic school, city hall, and the honey-baked ham store. We would have done more, but my friend Adam, who took the pictures, said we needed to have a beer. He'd be up for invading the moon if there was beer, Brian said. Behind the theater of the absurd humor, Stone has a serious message. Muslims are Americans. They're just like everybody else, he told me. They don't deserve to be treated differently. Actually, he feels he has a personal stake in this. I'm about as diverse as it gets for a white guy. I'm gay, I'm Buddhist, and I've served in the military. Stone had the guts to come out in high school. That meant a lot of severe harassment, including being beaten up. One day it dawned on him that even though school had been hell, I'd never heard a word against me from a Muslim. In fact, a friend named Muhammad told him, "Somebody tries to mess with you, you tell me." Gradually, Stone realized that his Muslim friends were trying to defend their community of Americans from the same people that wanted to keep me from having equal rights. Today, he said, "Dearborn is the only place in the world where I feel like everybody is really welcomed home." He feels that for both Muslims and gay Americans, it's a place where people really value them for what they are. Stone, who graduates from the U of M Dearborn this spring, wants to dedicate himself to making things better. You can imagine how upsetting it is to hear people making generalizations about the Arabic community, Muslims, and my hometown. Someday, he may try to run for office, but for now, he feels that laughter is the best medicine. After all, it's the one weapon with which fundamentalists of any kind are unable to cope.
You're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This is the new WHFR Journal for Friday, January 30th, 2015. Let's look at the Dearborn Press and Guide from this Wednesday now. On the front page, a friend of the show, Kader Farhat, has got a, well, he's got about two-thirds of the front page. You know, he's a 21-year-old legally blind scholar, mentor, and motivator, as the article says here. He's making a difference in Dearborn. He's doing a lot. He's getting around to, well, the various media like WHFR, where he's appeared, I think, three times now altogether over the last couple of years. And he did, he is continuing his education at Henry Ford College in special education and in law areas. In this last June, and I didn't realize this, he's only been in this country for 6 years. He emigrated here with his parents from Lebanon. And in June, he became a U.S. citizen. That's not easy to do. A lot of tests, a lot of studying, you know, folks. And he's, I really like him. He's really very energized and energizing. And, of course, that's one reason that he is also acting as sort of a mentor and a motivator for other young people who are blind, too. He mentors specifically challenged students at Lincoln Park Middle School once a week, teaches Braille and Arabic and English, and volunteers at many other organizations. So, nice. And they did some nice pictures of him, too, that he provided. Let's see here. The story above that, though, and not really the headline story, because the headline is really big for Kader Farhat. It's entitled Special-Abled. Special-Abled. Because people with special challenges can actually do a lot of special things. And you don't want to call them any other names these days, but that's a term that he's coined, special-abled. The story at the top of the page, though, from this Wednesday's Press and Guide, says, community rallies behind imam who threatens to resign. Well, okay, if you read the story, it seems like that he's threatened to resign because he can't work with sort of their board of directors at the Islamic Center of America. Okay. And it's called something else. They're not called board of directors, but the people in the church who control the direction of the church, you know, the religious facility. And it says here in the third paragraph, in letters distributed, probably among Muslim community members, near the end of 2014, just about a month ago, and the imam's name is Kazwini, if I pronounce Al-Kazwini. If I pronounce that incorrectly, I apologize. Okay. Q-A-Z-W-I-N-I. Anyway, he was accused in these letters of diverting funds to his family and to Iraq and other misdeeds. Now, he's denied the allegations, although I'm not sure he explained why they're inappropriate in detail. I'm not sure what evidence he gave. That's not reported here in the story. But he did thank all the people of the Islamic Center of America, the members of that community, for their support. And he announced the decision last Friday during a sermon with the Young Muslim Association, which also meets at the mosque, which is 19,500 Ford Road. So that's just a topic going on there, and that will be, of course, handled by the people of that community. I hope that in terms of charges like that, it's really, you know, it's character assassination. It's libel if it's in print. If it's not true, you can sue about that. But even if you win the a civil suit in court, I happen to know, not that I've been victim or ever done this, but I know that all you get out of it is money. If your image has already been hurt, it's hard to get that changed by a mere payment of dollars to you. So he's not saying he's going to sue. Again, he's denied the allegations, but he is threatening to resign. So we'll see what happens if you're interested. But I guess my only point in covering the story, since I'm not part of that community, is to just indicate that I hope all the facts come out, at least to those that need to know, and that everything is straightened out, that when this story gets into the press, it makes people look bad, obviously, when perhaps they shouldn't look bad at all. That's one problem with the media reporting these stories. You know, oh, somebody's getting sued by so-and-so. Yeah, but that story hurts the image in the community of the person that was talked about. So, oh, he's being sued. There must be some reason for it. Well, not necessarily. There might be some reasons, but they may not be, interpreted correctly. And, of course, a court of law could sort that out. But I'm just saying that the story itself, just by being published, does become kind of a negative. It fosters a negativity towards the person who's been sued or challenged or criticized when perhaps that shouldn't even be in the paper. I don't know. If it happens, it gets out in the public, I guess it's a public issue then. Okay. District 7 that we've talked about over there in Dearborn Heights, they do have an interim superintendent. Kind of interesting. The man's name is John Fraser. While they go about hiring a full-time person, by the way. And he is going to be driving in from their home, which is 60 miles away. So it's going to be quite a drive every day, unless he only comes in a couple days a month. I don't know. But nonetheless, John Fraser is going to be doing the task as interim superintendent while they hire a new superintendent. The previous superintendent did officially resign January 20th, 2 months after he started an unexplained personal leave. But it was really only 7 months after he started working in District 7. He cited continued health and personal issues. So welcome, John Fraser, out there in District 7. Usually when they bring in people as interim, they can't then go ahead and be one of the applicants for the permanent job. Just because they'd have inside advantage of knowing all the you know, what's going on, and they'd be able to answer the questions a lot better than the people on the outside. So I don't know. It doesn't say in the article about that, but that's probably the case. Okay, does it say that? I'm turning the page, folks. Yeah, he's going to serve an interim superintendent until at least the summer when they get a full superintendent in. I mean, a permanent superintendent. So it pretty much indicates he's can't apply for the job himself. Okay. Anyway, there you go. Craig Ferran's op-ed in the Press and Guide from Wednesday says, sometimes charts tell the best story of all. And his essays are longer than what I can usually cover completely here, but an intelligent guy, a lot of important research, and he points out 35-year chart of middle-class wages, how they've stagnated over 35 years, and how they're now declining since 2007. And it's pretty bad. So when people say there's a divide between rich and poor, it's getting worse. And the middle class is almost not existing anymore, which is a real problem, again, for the future of our country. I see personally, as since I and my parents came out of the middle class, thank you very much, America, it's almost going to be impossible for anyone else to be part of the middle class if wages continue to go down, opportunities go down, economic burden of higher education continues to climb, and the rich have not suffered at all, okay? Even right after the recession, their wages are going up startlingly for the 1%. And I have other documents here, too. One is a very frustrating. If I can pull it out. There's been a big study done by those college professors. You know those college professors, okay? Always doing a study on something. And in this case, that's called scientific research, though, folks. I know some studies have variables, and it takes a few to validate them and so on. But there was a major report that came out, an abstract, here it is, in a journal called Perspectives on Politics. You know, it's publish or perish at four-year schools. Either they do the work and they get critically accepted and approved articles published, studies published, or they don't keep their job. And here's the abstract of what they did. They were testing theories of American politics, such as the elites, interest groups, and average citizens, and how they relate. What they found is that, and they use multivariate analysis, which means they control a lot of variables. They look at a lot of things at the same time and overlap them and so on. They indicate that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. They say the results provide substantial support for the theories of economic elite domination. And you know what that is. I don't have to explain that, right? Who's your boss? Who's controlling America? And what actually finally happens? And who gets the benefits? The elite. The richest. That's a theory, but this major, major study has proven that, has supported that quite clearly. And also, it supports the theories of biased pluralism. In other words, pluralism means a lot of different groups are all participating and inputting into the society, as I understand it. But biased pluralism means that some groups, like the businesses and the rich, have an awful lot more influence. And in fact, this was a professor of politics at Princeton University, primary researcher, Martin Gillens, and he's written a book, Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, that was published just 3 years ago now in 2015. He published in 2012. That's a whole big book if you want to read that. But the study that's just been released updates everything he said in that book. And it's quite clear. Now, it is very frustrating for a show like this show, where we constantly remind you to do what you can to call your representatives and send emails and form groups, if you will, and take up contributions for noble causes, to actually have a study that says, eh, it'll have almost no effect, if any. I mean, almost no effect, very little effect, if any. Very frustrating. I understand, and this might give a basis for a lot of people saying, I don't vote. You know, it won't make a difference. That's right. Voting alone won't make a difference. I have to agree with you there. But if you do everything you can think of as a citizen and try to educate yourself and talk to people openly and get their ideas and try to work on issues and relate to your representatives too, however that can happen, got to let them know what you're thinking and what you care about. Representative democracy is not easy at all. And it's not, as I know one person here in the college that feels that we're not a democracy at all in America. It's called a representative democracy. It's not the same thing. And our representatives usually don't support the majority of people in what they do, nor even care about helping the majority of people. So that's a problem. And so we have some documentation. So read Craig Foran's article in the Press and Guide. That's one spin on it. And maybe Martin Gillen's book, Affluence and Influence, if you got the time. Maybe that's in your local public library. Thank you for public libraries. Well, what else is happening here? District 7, we just talked about, they got a technology bond issue coming up. That's why they need an interim superintendent to lead the bond proposal, I guess. It's a technology bond, and they're going to go for it on February 24th. $4.6 million they say they need. And it's important to realize, of course, that the board will be talking about this this coming Monday, I think. Is it the first meeting? The forums will take place Monday and Tuesday, and the first will be at 7 p.m. this coming Monday at Annapolis High School. On Clippard, Board of Ed meeting Monday at Clippard, and the two others will take place Tuesday at Polk Elementary School. The forums are at 10:30 a.m. and 4 p.m. So the first one is 7 p.m. next Monday, and then at Polk, they'll have one for the daytime folks at 10:30 a.m. and one at 4 p.m. So you want to figure out what's going on. It'll cost, if approved, the bond will cost 2.7 mils for residents, or about $82.50 annually for the owner of a $60,000 house. The money will be paid back over 10 years. And all kinds of special technology-type projects. Video camera systems for inside and outside the building. That's security, folks. Everybody's upgrading their security. Essential network security upgrades, a keyless entry system throughout the district, upgrades to school office security, and technology upgrades, of course, like computer labs in all the schools need to be updated, expanded wireless access, updated computer systems in general, the hardware, and upgraded network server hardware. All very, very important. The last time they got any technology from a bond issue was back in 1999. That's way back in the last millennium, folks. 16 years ago, and that was paid off, that bond was paid off in 2010. If they're still using 1999 computers, they're not being educated on current computers. Let me just put it, I'd be surprised if any of those still work even. So it seems like to me, who knows technology, they desperately need that bond to pass, and you folks out there in District 7 have a big decision to make. And please vote, however, after you've researched it, if you think they really need it, if it's good for your kids, and you need to vote for it, I guess, right? Okay, and then I found in Section B3, which normally I don't bring in because there's kind of a lot of fluff in the back sections, not hard news, but soft news, very nice things, but anyway, thousands are expected to show up for World Wetlands Day this Monday. Did you know that? Ever celebrated World Wetlands Day? Well, it's going to take place from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Carlson High School down in Gibraltar. An anticipated 1,500 students from around Wayne County will participate in the event, featuring a number of interactive activities, presentations, and demonstrations. Ooh, interactive. One person talking to another. I love that. Or a computer talking to someone. Yeah. The celebration will be open for public visitation beginning at 9 to 11:45 a.m. and again from 12:30 to 3 p.m. I guess in between everybody takes time out for lunch and you can't observe that. That's not open to the public. So each February, World Wetlands Day is observed worldwide in recognition of the date in the International Treaty for the Conservation and Sustainable Utilization of Wetlands. That treaty was signed at the Ramsar Convention in 1971. And that convention does maintain a list of wetlands across the globe that are of international importance, and a list of totaling nearly 2,000 sites, including southeastern Michigan's Humbug Marsh. I've heard of that, of course, because I grew up downriver, and I've never been to Humbug Marsh. It sounds lovely. It is a wetland, and it does a lot for the species that live there, the animals, and for our environment in a number of ways. And it'd be something to find out more about. So good for Carlson for doing this and inviting all those students from all over Wayne County to be part of it. It's one of those vital elements of our ecosystem, you know, the thing that keeps us alive, the world around us. So it's very important. So let's all remember in some way and celebrate or try to find out more about wetlands on World Wetlands Day this coming Monday, February 2nd. Well, we're almost coming to the end. It is 2 p.m. now here on the new WHFR Journal. Joanne Kay is in the building, as they say. Usually about rock stars. Well, she's a rock star to the blues. There's no doubt about that. And she'll be starting her show shortly. Our podcast here cuts off about 2 minutes after. So I apologize always to our podcast listeners. Just little extra stories I toss in about those car things. The BBC, that's right, British Broadcasting Company, came to Detroit. And their top 10 debuts of brand new cars on their list. Nothing too surprising. The Chevy Bolt, the all-electric car from Chevy, maybe that's a concept, but maybe might come out in a couple of years. The Ford GT, which everybody decided now pretty much was the star introduction of that show. In terms of small cars, they really liked the Hyundai Santa Cruz concept. Okay, isn't out yet. They liked a fuel cell Honda. Remember Eddie Alderman last week said, fuel cells, that is hydrogen-powered cars, that's the way to go for the future if they ever figure out how to do it. And they also like the Alfa Romeo 4C Spider, which is the convertible version of a car that was supposed to have been released here 2 years ago. And finally, I think this summer, we might see the first hardtop version of the Alfa Romeo 4C